Our topic now is digging down an alternative application, and there's a handout. Somebody kindly added the spades, which I couldn't manage. I think they're rather impressive, actually. As we know, it's easy to do a superficial application. I have a special gift of superficial application, actually, and I can do it at a moment's notice without any preparation at all. So here's my sermon series on the early chapters of Genesis. Genesis chapter 1, the importance of creativity in daily life. Genesis chapter 2, the importance of family life. Genesis chapter 3, things go wrong in the best of families. Genesis chapter 4, things go really wrong in the best of families. The flood, we all need a fresh start occasionally. Chapter 12, it's good to find new tasks in life in old age. See, I can just go on for hours like that, you'll be pleased to know. I'm not sure why God gave me this gift, but I do have it, which means I need to focus very strongly on digging down in order to do application. So this is a new diagram. This is the first time it's been shown in public, so let's see if it works. We need spades to dig down in the Bible passage. What is there and why is it there? Why did the author write it? Why did God cause it to be written? What effects does God want to achieve in this congregation and with these hearers today? I read in Chris Green's commentary on Acts that we preachers should believe that God had this congregation and this Sunday in mind when he caused these words to be written. And I said to him once, "This is a wonderful idea, Chris." He said, "Yes, it was your idea." Well, I didn't remember it, but anyway, I'm happy to take the credit for it. But how wonderful to think that God has a purpose for this sermon on this particular Sunday, and he had that purpose in mind when he caused the scriptures to be written. So the scriptures are ancient documents, but God plans to use them from your lips this coming Sunday. But what do we need to dig down to find the meaning of the scriptures? And I've put a number of spades there. This sounds complicated, but in fact we do it. I'm only describing what we already do. It's not some great new plan. I'm just articulating what actually happens. Let's think about Galatians as the example. You'll need these spades. Well, just think about Galatians. The first part of Galatians 1 and 2 is So much kind of biography, isn't it? Autobiography of Paul. What happened, what he did. We need to think, well now, why is Paul telling us about himself? Why is Paul recounting his experience, his relationship with Jerusalem? And why is this relevant to the letter to the Galatians? That's a literary question and a linguistic question. Is Paul telling us we should never go to Jerusalem? No, he isn't. Paul's describing the way in which he received the gospel in order to contrast it with the false gospel. He's trying to demonstrate, as we saw yesterday, that his apostleship is not from men or by a man, but by Jesus Christ and God the Father who raised him from the dead. And we need literary or linguistic skills to work that out. But we also need historical and geographical skills or spades to dig away. We need to remember the significance of Jerusalem in the Bible, in the Old Testament. We need to remember what happened in Jerusalem. We need to remember that Paul was from Tarsus, not from Jerusalem, that he was a Jew of the diaspora, but that he had been taught in Jerusalem, but that he was converted in near Damascus and commissioned in Antioch. And then we see the significance of Peter arriving in Antioch and spoiling everything in Galatians chapter 2. But we also need an awareness of the relational and dramatic significance of the passage. So who is Paul? Has he been to Galatia? And that's a complicated question to answer, as some of you may know. But what's the drama between Paul and the apostles? What's the relationship between Paul and James and so on, and the people who come down from James? We need to be aware of the relational and dramatic side of this particular passage. The immediate context, of course, connecting Paul's description of another gospel in chapter 1 with the action of Peter in chapter 2 in withdrawing from fellowship with Gentile Christians. So we're seeing that Paul is describing as a heresy what is actually just an action of withdrawing fellowship. And we're thinking about chapters 1 and 2 of Galatians in the context of the whole book. And of course, we're digging down to the biblical theology which lies behind the New Testament and lies behind and within the text of the Scriptures. Otherwise, we won't be able to make sense of law and promise and Moses and circumcision and so on. And what we're looking for is the intended outcome. That is, what change does God want to achieve through the letter to the Galatians? What change does Paul want to achieve through the letter to the Galatians? And I think Paul has two audiences in mind. First of all, the oppressors, and secondly, the oppressed. And to one he's saying, don't enslave people. And to the others he's saying, don't be enslaved. Stand in freedom. But not just the intended outcome, but also why, that is the theology or the Christian worldview, which informs this outcome. And, well, let me ask you the question in Galatians, what is the theology or Christian worldview which shapes that intended outcome? The intended outcome is that Gentiles should not submit to circumcision, and that Jews should not require Gentiles to be circumcised. What's the intended outcome? Sorry, what's the worldview which supports that change of attitude in the churches in Galatia? That's a genuine question, hoping for a genuine answer. What theology does Paul use to achieve a change? Yes, absolutely. The power of the cross. There it is in chapter 1. Yeah. And? Yes, that's the promise of the gospel to the whole world. And so we have to live by promise rather than by law. And that means living by faith and not by doing things. But justification by faith in Jesus Christ. So it's not just a change of action Paul wants. He's looking for something deeper than that, isn't he? He's working for a change of mind, a theological change. And we're looking for the motivation for the change, and that is that everybody enjoys the freedom which God gives in the gospel. Everyone enjoys gospel freedom. That's the motivation. And what emotions does Paul use to affect this change? What are the emotions that he uses? We know what the truths are. What are the emotions? Anger, disbelief, perplexity, earnestness, yes. His earnestness, his passion, his love for the people as well. What does he say about childbirth? I can't imagine somebody wanting childbirth, but he's on about it in chapter 4, isn't he? For my dear children, for whom I am again in the pains of childbirth until Christ is formed in you. Extraordinary statement, isn't it? How deep his passion is for the Galatians. He raises the emotional temperature, doesn't he, by saying this is a different gospel and there can be no other gospel. That's raising the emotional temperature, isn't it? And he raises the emotional temperature by saying, let someone who preaches another gospel be accursed, when Christ has delivered us, rescued us from the curse of the law. So, you either receive a rescue from the curse of the law, or you are accursed. Well, that's certainly raising the emotional temperature, isn't it? Yeah. Now, I'll just hand around another paper, which will help us think about what we're looking for in the text. That's okay. Thanks. And here I'm developing the idea of looking for the emotions of the text. What we're trained to do in college and what we're trained to do by commentaries is to look for the meaning of the text. But I think the meaning of the text is important to look for, but there are more things to look for in a text than the meaning, because there are more things in the text than the meaning. And the more things are as inspired by the Holy Spirit as the meaning is. And often looking for the meaning is actually looking for a reduction in the text, not the full impact of the text. So when I'm looking at a Bible passage, here's the list. I'm looking for the shape of the passage, the meaning of the passage, the images of the passage, the emotions of the passage, the motivations of the passage, the theology, the instructions, the encouragements, the warnings, the affirmations, the urgings, and the purpose. And whatever shape, meaning, images, emotions, motivations, theology, instructions, encouragements, warnings, affirmations, urgings, and purpose are in the text, they should be in my sermon. I shouldn't be reducing what's in the text. My question should be not so that what is the irreducible minimum of the text, that is its meaning. I should be asking what's the maximum impact of the text, and try to communicate that maximum impact. So the little diagram is my artwork entirely. I'm very proud of this one. And it's trying to say that we're looking for the genre, shape, keywords, instructions, images, pictures, and so on. And then there's the target. That's the target there. And this is the sermon. But we're trying to find all these elements in the text and in the sermon. Now, this is important because sometimes in the search for meaning, we damp down the emotions of the text. And sometimes we miss the emotions of the text and import our own motivations of the text, sorry. We miss the motivations which are in the text and import our own motivations. And the classic evangelical motivation which we import into every text unless somebody stops us is the Bible says we must do this, so we must do it. Or God says we must do this, so we must do it. But what's the motivation in Psalm 1? Blessed is the man whose delight is in the law of the Lord, and on that law he meditates day and night. He'll be like a tree planted by streams of water. What's the motivation? A delight, that's right. And I want to be like a tree planted by streams of water, rather than chaff which the wind blows away. Yeah. come to me all who are labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. What's the motivation there?
Rest.
Not come to me because I tell you, you must do it. But come to me, and I will give you rest. And in the wonderful passage we looked at this morning, Paul says, as you'll all remember, we could have asserted our authority. Instead, we were like young children among you. Isn't that extraordinary? If I'd been an apostle, I would have exerted my authority all the time. Do this, don't do that. But Paul says, we were like young children among you. And he talks about our appeal, our begging you. We dealt with you, verse 11, and I'm sure Paul will deal with this, as a father deals with his own children, encouraging, comforting, and urging you. Well, that's very different to telling you, isn't it? When you encourage someone, you comfort them and you urge them, you're saying, this matters to me. Paul's saying, this matters to me. He's not saying just do this because God tells you to do it or I tell you to do it. He's saying, this matters to me. I appeal to you. And that's exactly what he's doing in Galatians. As I read a moment ago, my dear children, for whom I am in the pains of childbirth until Christ is formed in you, how I wish I could be with you now and change my tone. What I'm saying is, if you deliver the emotion, the emotional power of, if we are an angel of heaven, should preach a gospel other than the one we preach, let them be under God's curse. If you deliver that with emotional power, make sure you deliver, my dear children, for whom I am again in the pains of childbirth until Christ is formed in you, with similar emotional power. Don't pump up one and reduce the other. That's exactly right. That's right. Do this. Or believe this. That's right. Martin Lloyd-Jones once described the Bible as logic on fire. I don't think that's quite right, because lots of the Bible actually isn't logic. Narrative isn't logic. Some of Paul's letters are logic. But I think the Bible's better described as truth on fire. But it's passionate truth. It's not dispassionate truth. And what commentaries do is make passionate truth dispassionate. We should make passionate truth, not dispassionate truth. And the reason we do it is because we've swallowed the lie of our society that there's a big gap between mind and heart. That truth must be abstract and dispassionate. Well, that's certainly not the truth you find in the Bible. That's not dispassionate truth, it's passionate truth all the time. So can I encourage you? Yeah, sure. Sorry. Yes, sure. I've got a nervous tick, I need one of those things. Sorry for those who've seen this a million times before. The preacher and the congregation have to make two journeys. One is to the Bible, and the other journey is back to today. And it's important to help people make the full journey to the Bible and not shortcut it so it's you don't ever get to the Bible. But it's also important to make the journey back to today, of course. But here's the point. People need to be aware that they're going to another world and another age. So what we do is say, you know, as Paul says, you receive me as an angel of God, as Jesus Christ. Isn't that extraordinary? So when he went there to evangelize them, they received him as an angel of God, as Jesus Christ. They were so moved by his message. And he'd invested so much in them. This is me pumping up the story, you see. It was, you know, he'd labored over them and cared for them so much that it was like the pangs of childbirth. So what a close relationship that was. So how astonished he was when, just because people came from Jerusalem, they gave it all up. You know. How extraordinary that must have been for Paul. So we're trying to get into the mind and the heart of Paul, and his amazement and astonishment. I mean, you find the same things, don't you, in 2 Timothy chapter 1, 15, where he says, all those in Asia have deserted me. So you say, you know, we're surprised when people go off the rails nowadays, but how amazing when you've had a living apostle of the Lord Jesus Christ, whom you've received as Jesus Christ, and then you drift away so quickly. And reinforced by the fact that even Peter and Barnabas, his great colleagues in the ministry, who, you know, agreed that this is what the gospel is. See, so then you say, well, here's an immense danger. And you can pump it up even more by saying, and they changed just because people were pressuring them to do so. And they were afraid of the people. So wanting to be approved actually can make you drop the gospel. Isn't that extraordinary? But then I'd say, if the congregation hadn't dropped the gospel, how wonderful, dear friends, and how kind God is that we haven't turned away from the gospel. But what a danger this is. We must keep it in mind for the future, because we don't know what pressures will be upon us. And this will help us speak to others. We meet, because I meet people all the time who have been fine Christians and then have moved away from the gospel. So we can feel the drama of what's happening in Galatia without necessarily saying, and this is happening now, you know, you've all abandoned the gospel when you haven't. Yeah. But be very sure in every congregation of Bible-believing Christians there are those who are about to drift. Yeah. Exactly right. That's exactly right. That's right. And the great trap of preaching, as you all know so well, is that when you've got a congregation, let's say, here are the slackers over here, and here are the over conscientious over people over here. Whenever you preach, people hear the wrong message, don't they? When you preach grace, the slackers think, "Oh yes, I must slack even more," and the over conscientious people think, "I must work really hard at, you know." So exactly right. So, you need lots of pastoral skill, and even if you do your best, people still, after you preach grace till you're blue in the face, people still feel guilty because they haven't appreciated enough or something like that. Yeah, that's right. That's the reality of humans, I'm afraid. Yeah. What question did you ask, by the way? I'm feeling a bit vague this morning. Yeah, sure, sure. What is this? It's time for morning tea. Oh, it isn't yet. Where was I?
Asking, about communicating the emotion.
That's exactly right. Exactly right. That's right. So that was my point yesterday, I think. that the Bible is all relevant, but not all of it is immediately relevant. Now, we meet that, don't we, when doing a Bible study in John's Gospel with an inquirer, because, sorry for those who heard this before, we get to John chapter 5 and the paralyzed man, Jesus heals him and then says, go and sin no more. So then people think, well, that means if you're sick, it's because you've sinned. But then you get to John 9 and the disciples ask Jesus, who sinned, this man or his parents? The answer is neither. So sometimes sickness is the result of sin, sometimes it's not. And the great trap for young preachers is to universalize every Bible passage as if it is universally true of everybody. And it isn't. I pointed out yesterday, that's the mistake of Job's friends. In 99% of the cases, they were right. People were suffering because of their sin. But not this time. And that's why applying the Bible to individuals or to a congregation takes an immense amount of pastoral wisdom in knowing the state of the congregation or the state of the individual. Paul used to come to the Timothy Institute, didn't you, back in those days? That's right. Yeah, that's right. I remember I was talking at a Timothy Institute conference once, and I was expounding 1 Thessalonians, and I got to the bit where isn't it funny how Bible verses disappear when you're looking for them? Where does he say, you're our joy and our crown? Oh, our glory and our joy, exactly right. 1 Thessalonians chapter 2. Let's start at 17. When we were orphaned by being separated from you for a short time, in person, not in thought, out of the intense longing we made every effort to see you, we wanted to come to you, but Satan blocked our way. For what is our hope, our joy, or the crown in which we'll glory in the presence of our Lord Jesus Christ when he comes? Is it not you? Indeed, you are our glory and our joy. And I said that I'd been preaching through 1 Thessalonians at St. Jude's. And I'd stopped to say how much I loved them and how much they were my glory and my crown, in the sense that to see their spiritual growth was one of the great joys and hopes of my life. And one minister put up his hand and said, won't they become arrogant if you say that? As if affirming people was the most dangerous thing you could ever do, because they would take it the wrong way. So I said, well, they'd become discouraged if I don't say it, won't they? So, make sure that you communicate not just the motivation, but the emotions of the text as well. We're using, back to the previous bit of paper, we're using these different kinds of spades: literary, linguistic, historical, geographical, relational, contextual, biblical theology, to look for the intended outcome and the why and the motivation. Now we're going to use a different set of spades to dig down in our congregation, because we want to affect not just their surface actions, but the deepest springs of their hearts and personality, don't we? We don't want to just affect a superficial change where they do what we say without knowing why they're doing it, other than because you have to do what the preacher says. We don't just want a merely intellectual assent, nor do we want a merely emotional assent, nor do we want a merely practical assent to what we're saying. That would be the worst kind of response, wouldn't it be? Because it would be people whose hearts are not changed by the Word of God. And the Word of God does pierce our hearts, pierce the very source and springs of our personality and actions and thoughts. So, what do the congregation need to know, do, think, act on, feel, remember from this passage, and why? And why? And how can they teach and admonish others with this passage? That is, we want to teach them so well that they're enabled and empowered to teach others what they have learnt. So as we're teaching the Bible, we want them to hear, to understand, to welcome, absorb, meditate on, that is, reflect on, a Bible passage. We want them to feel it, believe it, understand it. Oh, I've had that before. We'll do it again anyway. It'll make you feel secure. Do it and teach it. And we'll need these spades in order to do it. An educational spade, that is, what do they know, what do they not know? What do they need to know to understand this passage? We'll need relational spades, that is, how members of the congregation, how the congregation as a whole, relate to this passage when they hear it. We need a communication spade, that is, we need the skills and awareness of how we can communicate this passage to this congregation. We need cultural awareness of them. What sort of background do they come from? And how will this influence the way in which they misread or mishear this passage? And how can I help people from this culture understand this particular passage? But then certainly, this is true in Australia, subculture is even more important than culture. So bikies are very unlike bankers. So I need to think of the various subcultures of the people in the congregation. Old people are very unlike young people. And by old, I mean older than me. And by younger, I mean anybody under 60, really. Subcultures are so important. I need to think what Christian tribe people in the congregation belong to. What background? So you might have a congregation which comes, they're all from the same Christian tribe, or you might have people from a Reformed tribe or a Charismatic tribe or a soft evangelical tribe or something like that. There are different tribes represented. And then what's the history of the congregation? What people, how many unbelievers are there here? How many inquirers are there here? How many mature Christians? How many drifting mature Christians? And awareness of different attitudes, theologies, experiences, sorts of people, and stages. Now, this is not an area of my strength. I have to work very hard on this. So when I began preaching, I used to spend all my time on the text and no time thinking about the congregation. Indeed, I'm embarrassed to say that I thought of preaching as my performance, not as a ministry. So 15 or 20 years ago, I decided this was wrong and I should spend half my preparation time on thinking about the text and half my preparation time praying for the congregation and thinking about them. and thinking, when they hear this Bible passage read, what will they make of it? What will they understand? What will they automatically misunderstand? What will they welcome? What will they reject? What information do they need to understand it? How can I help them cope with the bits they find difficult or which will make them angry? And how can I win them to accept the passage and respond to it? And how can I help them grasp not just the surface meaning of the passage, but its deepest theology? So I change them radically, not just superficially. I found that exercise a very productive exercise, mingling it with praying for the people, as well as thinking about, I used to think about representative people, so think of one particular inquirer or one particular young Christian or one particular mature Christian or one particular person going through a difficult time. I try to think of men and women as well as children in those different categories, trying to increase my awareness of the people to whom I'm preaching. It's the kind of thing that you do when you're sitting down with an individual. You're very attentive to them and to what to their questions and their objections or their insights or whatever it is. So try and use the same skills with the congregation. And I'm trying to dig down in the congregation, as it were, as I have dug down in the text, to find not only what they believe, but why they believe it. I want to expose not only what they know, but what they don't know. I want to expose the deep assumptions which lie behind the way in which they live. That is, the worldviews which inform the way they live. So, as an example, I never preach on sin nowadays without spending 5 minutes on the glory and dignity of humanity. Because if people have lost the doctrine of creation, they've lost the doctrine and the confidence that God intended them and loves them and has a great purpose for them. They've lost the fact that they're made in God's image. That is, they have a glorious destiny to be men and women and children made in God's image for God's glory. But if you think you're an accidental speck of cosmic dust, that you have no creator because you're your own creator, and somebody says you're a sinner, then you'll think, well, I'm really worthless, you see. I'm just an accident. And all that I am is worthless and has no meaning, no destiny, no purpose. So when I say you're a sinner, you'll feel, well, that's true. I mean, I'm just worth nothing. Because actually, if you're made in the image of God, you're worth everything. That's not flattering people. That's saying we're made with a glorious destiny, a glorious dignity. It's Psalm 8, isn't it? What is man that you are mindful of him? You made him little lower than the angels, crowned him with glory and honor. I'm only saying what the Bible is saying. And that, of course, is why sin matters. So if a snail sins, it doesn't matter. If I sin, it does matter. The slightest sin matters precisely because God has a great destiny for human beings. So I'm trying to give an example of trying to be aware of people's worldview and how it will distort their hearing of the scriptures. But the other contradictory thing, of course, is that people at the same time think that they're the most important person in the world. So I then have to jab that idea, poke that idea, and say it's a ridiculous idea, because if you think you're an uncreated, a speck of cosmic accidental, how on earth could you be the most important person in the world? And certainly you're not the most important person in the world. God is, and your neighbour is more important than you are. So we have to deal with the great confusion that lives within the secular worldview. On the one hand, as the Cambridge scientist said, if we don't play God, who will? Yet in the view that we have no significance at all. Well, no wonder people are confused and anxious and depressed with all that rubbish floating around. And people don't know the confusion that lies within them, so we have to expose it in order to make room for the glorious truth of God. So I'm digging down into the text and digging down into the congregation. Yeah? And from that I will then want to preach the message. But I won't want to preach it in terms of, express it in terms of, this is a worldview or this is a theology. I'll want to use key phrases from the passage to convey the change we're talking about. But of course, our understanding of the passage and our use of these phrases or words in the passage is informed by all that digging we've done. Okay, now, I feel particularly incoherent this morning, so if you're feeling confused, it's not your fault, it's my fault. So let's have 10 minutes for questions and possibly some answers. Yeah.
How do you avoid the danger of therefore making every message the same in terms of the passage specifically about sin?
Yeah.
Another one next week about humanity.
Yeah.
Because you're going to talk. I can see the danger perhaps that every time you're speaking about a passage, you lose the balance of the text.
Yes, of course, that's right. That's right. Yeah, that's right. Well, I'd keep in mind, have I banged this drum recently? The trouble is I move around, so it's very hard for me to know what's going on. But if I was in the same place, if I've banged a drum recently, I'll give it a break, because I'm aware of the danger of preachers preaching their hobby horses. And I know what mine are, and I observe how frequently they seem to emerge. I tell people, if you don't know what your hobby horses are, you have them, please ask your wife, because she will know them and your congregation will know them. And please take a vow not to preach them for the next year, to give everybody a break. So when I'm saying I always do that, I'm exaggerating. Apologies, Paul. But if I think it's appropriate in this particular context, I will do that. I'm trying to say I'm aware of the danger of preaching sin to people who don't believe they're created. That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
But why? Why? Absolutely, we don't like sin. We don't like to do it.
Yeah.
Why pick on that one? Neither do we like holiness.
Yeah.
Neither do we like. There are heaps of doctrines that we find difficult to stomach or receive or let alone live. Why? Like, you're obviously going to. When God says no, we don't like to hear that. Why not just pick out the theology of the text and preach the theology of the text?
Yes, I will still preach sin.
Yeah.
And indeed, by showing that we're made by God and accountable to God, I'm actually increasing the significance of sin. Because here's another hobby horse I have. Most people think about sin horizontally. They think they've hurt somebody else, they have to apologize. Even among evangelicals who keep on singing about the atonement, when I ask them, what sins do you regularly commit? I ask ministers that question, and they stare at me with amazement, and they don't know what the answer is. I say, what sins are you putting to death every day? And they don't know the answer to that question. I think you must live an extraordinary life if you don't need to put some sins to death every day. I have countless sins I have to put to death every day, and I usually fail to do so. And then I ask them, what sins of ministry do you habitually commit? And they stare at me with amazement. They haven't thought about that question. So I think in our evangelical tribe, if I may say so, there's a profound lack of awareness of sin. So I bang that drum too. Because I say, what hinders your ministry is not your lack of gifts or lack of resources or lack of time, it's your sin. That's the only barrier. So I do that one as well, Mark. Don't worry. Don't worry. And if we have a little... I'll have a coffee, I'll say, Mark Hood, what sins have you put to death today? Joe.
Looking at your
target crowd here.
Yeah.
One question is, being in the room primarily white European, non-emotional people, evangelical, probably rather terrified of being perhaps confused with the Bible. We tend to be very wordy people. And we work really hard to say meaning, get the meaning of the word right, and explain the meaning of the text. I think what I understand you saying is we work just as hard at being able to express the emotion we can in the intensity of the passage. Is that what you're trying to think?
It is, it is. That's what I'm trying to say. Yes, that's exactly right. Yes. Yeah.
That's definitely something I would not find natural.
No, that's right. You wouldn't. It is. That's exactly right. Yes, that's right. And if you're a boring person as I am, with a boring voice, it's very difficult. Yeah. When I was encouraged, I was advised to read plays out loud to try and develop different emotions, fear, anger, so on, and express them out loud. Because what we want to do is not damp down the emotions in the text, but express them. I mean, I often use the example of Luke 15. You know, the three parables: loss, joy, shared joy, anger, fear, frustration, pain, compassion. They're all there in the text. We don't want to sort of analyze them at a distance, say, isn't this interesting? We want people to feel them. But why else did Jesus tell those stories? And I think one of our lost arts is actually imagination. So I try to encourage people to imagine the scene in their mind. Why would you damp that down? Same with the book of Revelation. You can analyze it, but why not imagine it? It's a much more powerful book. If you imagine it, let me tell you, it's exhausting. But let's engage with the emotions rather than damping them down. And the damping down of emotions is the result of the Enlightenment and rationalism. It is not part of evangelical history. In fact, if you read Whitfield and Wesley, they're busy pumping up the emotions as hard as they can. Yes, yeah. Yeah.
But actually, it does come from
that. Yes, that's right. Yes. Well, it's also a lie about God, I think, and even more fundamentally, yes. It's slightly embarrassing that Jesus cries over Jerusalem, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, it's not very appropriate. No, that's right. But that's only recent English, if I might say so. So Simeon, Charles Simeon, was bursting into tears all the time. It, you know, every day he burst into tears about something. It's a kind of late 19th century English view, as a matter of fact. So it's merely a cultural affectation. And it's not appropriate, I think, to impose it on the world of the Bible. Yes, sure. Yes, sure.
What you said about fundamentally actually listening to God is quite interesting. Years ago, Mark Jones published a book on devotion on the attributes of God, similar kind of to all the Predator tradition. But in reading it, I was really, I think, effectively down on knowing what things can express the character of God does affect me, should often affect us to see in a personal way. And in those senses, it sounds crazy. We're all concerned with these levels here, but we perhaps have had it as long as you
Yes. Yeah. It's a misunderstanding of the impassibility of God. God is without body parts or passions. Strictly speaking, that means, to say without passions, he is not, his actions and life are not shaped by external forces. But if you ask, does God himself have passions within him? Well, boy, the answer is very clear, he does. But often, the funny thing is, evangelicals are very keen about God's anger and God's wrath. They think God feels that very deeply, but think his love is somewhat more restrained. That's exactly right. That's right. That's exactly right. Yes. Yeah. That's right. So Zephaniah, the end of Zephaniah is terrific, isn't it? And the end of Jude. He'll present us to himself with great joy. You think, really?
So what is it about the charismatic church gets that, but the evangelical church, the reformed church doesn't?
Yeah. Yes, I wrote an article for a book. The book was on Wesley and Whitfield and on their debates, and I was doing Sin and Atonement, I think it was. And at the end of the chapter I said, you know, I think Wesley is wrong at almost every point, except one, and that is, if you ask Whitfield who you are, he would say, I'm a sinner. If you ask Wesley who you are, he'd say, I'm a saint. Now, how does the New Testament describe us? Saints. So amazing, isn't it? I know we're still sinners, but we are saints. Actually,
speaking about the way that, you know, sorry, I'm going to have some vague of the fire and emotional attack.
Yeah.
When that's happening, we're expecting the sermon doing that. It kind of raises the question, you know, how much responsibility does the preacher have for response to the conversation, even in that environment? So sometimes I feel like you try and do that, then kind of take people by surprise or you might not have a response. I'm just interested in your thoughts on the before and after and around.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. That's right. That's a great question. Thank you so much. Because if we're just imparting abstract information, then we didn't worry about too much about the response.
Exactly.
But if we're actually wanting to change and challenge people, then we should think very carefully and act responsibly and pastorally about the process of the sermon and the response to the sermon afterwards. That's exactly right. But I think it shouldn't be a surprise. That is, I think people should expect to meet the emotions of the text and not be surprised when they meet it. So we'd need to lead them slowly into it, I think. But I think patterns many churches have of having people at the front after, if you want to go out and pray with somebody, then someone's there to pray with you. I think that's a great thing. As I think it's important to be... I communicate the judgment and wrath and anger of God very well. That's easy for me. I can make people feel guilty even if they're not. What I find difficult is to communicate the love of God, and I find lament very difficult. I find, you know, I'm naturally an immensely private person, so I find I need to be aware of the things I find difficult, the emotions I find difficult to communicate, and work hard at thinking not just how can I feel these, but how can I communicate these to people without damaging them. Yeah. I think it's time for our morning tea.